The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Susan Hennessy, and this is the Lawfare Podcast.
Shorts.
March 6th, 2019. On Tuesday, I interviewed FBI Director Christopher Wray at the 2019 RSA conference. We discussed how the director views the cyber threat landscape 18 months into his term, his concerns about the threats posed by Russia and China, what the FBI is doing to protect the 2020 elections, and more. It's the Lawfare Podcast.
Shorts.
FBI Director Wray on combating cyber threats.
FBI occupies a really interesting space, in part because it plays roles across both national security and criminal law enforcement areas. You've been in the director's seat at the Bureau for a year and a half now. So I want to start by getting a sense of your perspective on the landscape. 18 months in, how do you view the cyber threat?
I would say that I knew cyber was going to be probably our top priority in many ways. I think the scope, the breadth, the depth, the sophistication, the diversity of the threat that we face now is unlike anything we've had in our lifetimes, whether you look at the range of actors from multinational cyber syndicates to foreign intelligence services to insider threats, hacktivists, you could go on and on, or whether you look at the range of victims from global publicly traded companies all the way to startups, mom and pops, both businesses, public sector, nonprofits, or if you look at the range of attack methods, whether you're talking about spear phishing all the way to ransomware, botnets, DDoS attacks, you could go on and on and on. So I think in particular we're seeing a greater uptick in the threat from various foreign adversaries, China, Russia, Iran, North Korea, and an increasing trend towards what we call the blended threat, which is really when a foreign intelligence service enlists the help of criminal hackers, essentially mercenaries, and we're seeing that more and more. So I look at some of the things that we've had just over the last few months, and I think it gives you a flavor of the point that I was making. I mean, we've had, just in the last few months, we had, the case against the Chinese Ministry of State Security hackers for an extensive IP theft campaign against, I think, 45 different companies all around the world. We had the Iranian nationals who were responsible for the SAMSAM ransomware, which crippled, hospitals and local governments and various other public institutions. We had a big sweep on the other end of the spectrum of an international business email compromise sweep, where just in a single sweep covering three different continents, we had probably something like 75 different arrests all over the U.S., different continents around the world. We had the North Korean government hacker who was charged for his role in everything from the Sony Pictures attack to the Bank of Bangladesh heist to the WannaCry ransomware. We had the Russian GRU officers who were charged for their participation in an extensive hacking campaign that was designed to destabilize the international anti-doping agencies. So you could go on and on, but that's just a small sample of what we're facing. And certainly we're trying very, very hard to stay laser focused ahead of the threat.
So against this backdrop, we've seen sort of recent reporting about U.S. Cyber Command's role in offensive operations. We hear a lot about what the Department of Homeland Security's role might be with regards to federal civilian infrastructure. I'm curious to hear sort of what part of the mission you would claim as unique to the FBI, right? There's a lot of cooks in the kitchen right now, and sort of what does the FBI bring that these many other elements don't or can't?
Well, first off, I think as my previous comment might have illustrated, my view is that today's cyber threat is bigger than any one government agency, frankly, bigger than government itself. But I think no agency brings the same combination of scope and scale, experience, tools, relationships that the FBI has. I mean, starting with the fact that, as my earlier comments probably illustrated, you know, the cyber threat is really a multidisciplinary threat with a very wide range of bad guys, with a very wide range of motives, plans, and intentions. So it requires a multidisciplinary response. The FBI has been the lead domestic law enforcement and counterintelligence agency for 110 years. And then you look at things like we have, you know, technically trained personnel covering 350 some odd offices around the U.S. between our field offices and our smaller offices. We have an elite rapid deployment force, our cyber action team, which can respond to a cyber incident pretty much anywhere in the world. We have cyber task forces, a lot like the JTTFs in the terrorism context all over the country, that even though they're FBI-led, we couldn't do without the participation of members of something like 200 different federal, state, and local law enforcement agencies that work with us on it. We have a 24-hour watch floor, cyber watch floor in D.C. that is responsible for coordinating U.S. law enforcement's response and tracking victim notification. And then we have what a lot of people don't realize, we even have a lot of personnel overseas. We have LEGAT offices, you know, in something like 65-plus countries, and a whole bunch of those have dedicated cyber, what we call ALATs, assistant legal attachés, embedded in those offices. And then we have things like our Office of Technology Division, which for anybody who's watched the James Bond movies is sort of like RQ, you know, who has the unbelievably cool cutting-edge tools that we use for all of those missions. So you put all that together, and we do our part.
So most of this audience approaches these challenges from a private sector perspective. So I'm curious sort of what your view is of the role of the private sector in countering the kinds of cyber threats that you care about and sort of, you know, help us understand what does that relationship look like? What are the challenges there?
Well, I used the analogy of the terrorism context before and talking about some of the things that we have. I would argue that in the cyber arena, the need for private sector partnership is higher than really anywhere else of any program we have. I mean, start with the fact that I think something like 90% of the United States' critical infrastructure is in the hands of the private sector, which is not true in lots of countries around the world. And that's just critical infrastructure. So the reality is we couldn't do what we do without the private sector and vice versa. The key is having the private sector start to form those kinds of relationships with their local field office beforehand, because the name of the game, as this audience would know better than almost anybody, is not just prevention, but in many cases it's going to be mitigation. And that's a place where speed really matters. And speed is much more likely to occur when there's an existing relationship. The other problem is that, of course, if you only look at one company's cyber incident in isolation, quite often it's going to turn out to actually be something that has ramifications in a bunch of other sectors as well. And there's no way for one side or the other to know that unless we broaden our collective knowledge. So we're trying to do a lot more forward-leaning things than we have historically. You know, we had a tendency to be very close hold with information, and we still have obligations to do that. But we're trying to do a lot more routinely things like defensive classified briefings for companies where we alert them to certain threats, try to give them, in effect, a form of guidance to help them get ahead of the game a little bit. And we've had some pretty good success with that. But we're also doing things, we have a lot of programs with everything from CISOs to general counsels. Some of them are local, some of them are more national. And so I think at the end of the day, we need each other in a way that I think is becoming more and more apparent every day. I could give an example. I mean, it might be a little counterintuitive. We had one case just a few years ago where there was a guy who, through hacking, obtained the names of like 1,200 different U.S. military members and U.S. government personnel and provided it as a kill list to ISIS. We would not have gotten that information if not for important information sharing from the private sector. So, again, that symbiotic relationship.
So that answer sort of touches on how incredibly important the private sector is here. The last time there was a big sort of public focus on FBI private sector engagement was sort of around the rather contentious showdown with Apple related to the use of end-to-end encryption. So how do you reconcile those two things?
Well, look, I have, unlike some FBI directors, actually spent a certain amount of time in the private sector representing companies before this latest stint in government. What I would say is that just as technology has become a force multiplier for the good guys, it has become a force multiplier for the bad guys, for terrorists, hackers, spies, criminals. And what I know is that not a week goes by where I don't encounter across basically all of our programs some significant, sometimes insurmountable impediment from some of those same criminals, hackers, spies, et cetera, hiding with encrypted devices or encrypted messaging platforms. And so it's a public safety issue that we're concerned about. Now, I'm well aware of that this is a provocative subject. My first approach to these things is not to try to go to war with anybody over it. I get a little frustrated when people suggest that we're trying to weaken encryption. To be clear, those are not our words. We're not trying to weaken encryption. We're not seeking the back doors any more than I think the folks, the well-intentioned critics on the other side, are trying to weaken public safety. But I do know that this is an issue that's getting worse and worse all the time, and every state and local law enforcement leader I deal with, every member of the intelligence community I deal with, every foreign partner I deal with, is raising this issue with growing urgency. And so while we are a very strong believer in strong encryption, after all, cybersecurity is part of the FBI's mission too, we're also duty-bound to protect the American people. And we have to figure out a way to deal with this problem. It can't be a sustainable end state for there to be an entirely unfettered space that's utterly beyond fully lawful access for criminals, terrorists, and spies to hide their communications. And so what I would like to see, since I believe that the U.S. has the finest law enforcement and national security community in the world and the most innovative private sector in the world, I would love to see people try to come together to work towards solutions. And increasingly, during my first 18 months, in private conversations from experts, you know, cryptographers, cryptologists, et cetera, I'm hearing increasingly that there are solutions to be had if people are willing to put their heads together. And so that's what I hope we can accomplish.
So switching to a less controversial topic, Russia. We've heard a lot of mixed messages on this subject, and so I want to get your view on this. Do the Russians still pose a threat to U.S. elections, and do they pose a threat of more broadly covert influence on our society?
Yes. No. Absolutely. I mean, the Russians have... We have not seen in the most recent midterm election a material impact on election infrastructure from a foreign adversary like Russia. But what we have seen, what has continued virtually unabated and just intensifies during the election cycles, is this malign foreign influence campaign, especially using social media, but lots of other techniques as well, to sow divisiveness and discord, to pit Americans against each other, to undermine our faith in democracy, And that continues. And we're gearing up for it to continue and grow again for 2020.
So what are you doing to prepare for 2020?
Well, a number of things. Across different agencies, we're all taking different efforts to try to beef up our own role. At the FBI, for example, we created a foreign influence task force, which brings together both cyber, counterintelligence, criminal, even counterterrorism, all trying to have sort of a multidisciplinary hub that then has the spokes going out to our field offices. We worked very closely with NSA and DHS and ODNI in particular, those three last in the midterms. And I think the real good news story is there's a lot more engagement with other partners, a lot more engagement with the social media companies this time around in a way where we provide them with information, they're able to take action using their own tools, policing their own platforms, and then in turn there may be situations where they provide useful lead information for us, so there's a little bit more of that virtuous cycle going. And there were quite a number of really encouraging success stories. Frankly, I think it's a great example of how government and the private sector can work together in a common defense.
So the past few years have sort of been dominated by this discussion of Russia. What we've seen sort of out of Capitol Hill and in the media is there's always sort of a cyber threat actor of the moment. So Russia or Iran or North Korea, for a while it was the cyber caliphate. I think it's fair to say sort of attention has now refocused on China. Is that emphasis sort of well-founded, or are we overly focusing on specific threats at the expense of a broader strategic conversation?
I don't think we're overly focused. I would argue that for too long, this country has actually been under-focused on the counterintelligence threat, which has a heavy cyber dimension, but it's not exclusively a cyber issue that China poses. There is nothing like it, and I'm not somebody who is prone to hyperbole, but of all the things that surprised me when I came back into this world, the thing that most shocked me was the breadth and the depth, the scale of the Chinese counterintelligence threat. We have economic espionage investigations in basically all 56 field offices, almost all of which lead back to China. It covers every sector of the economy. It covers academia. In the last, just this fall, we had, I think, maybe four different times where we charged, and those are just the ones we charged, either hackers working for the Chinese government or others associated with the MSS or other parts of the Chinese government trying to steal American intellectual property or attack American businesses. So it's a real issue.
So I want to ask a little bit of a pointed question, and that's that the Department of Justice has made a number of high-profile arrests and indictments against Chinese citizens and Chinese companies. To what extent is that being driven by our ongoing trade discussions with the Chinese government?
So not at all. Okay. This is not about trade. It's not about politics. It's not even about diplomacy. It's about the rule of law. And we're going to, in everything we do, as long as I have anything to say about it, we're going to follow the facts independently, wherever they may lead, to whomever they may lead, no matter who likes it. And that means when we find somebody who's committing federal crimes against Americans or American businesses, we're going to go after them. And I don't really care what some foreign government has to say about it.
So, that answer great. Sort of stepping back on the same theme, but more broadly speaking, you know, do you think that the justice system is an effective deterrent for cyber-enabled IP theft or election interference, right? So does naming and shaming actually work?
Well, first off, indictments, I think, are just one part of a much more of a whole-of-government strategy in terms of enforcement. I will say that one of the things that hackers of all shapes and sizes prize the most in this world is anonymity and stealth and deniability. And by indicting them publicly, among other things, we strip them of that. And we've seen lots of instances where particular hackers have now become essentially persona non grata and unable to get work. I know it breaks your heart. Because they've been called out. Second, the indictment allows often other parts of the government to impose additional costs, so there are additional sanctions that can flow from that. Third, I think it's a little bit of a myth that these people would never see the inside of a U.S. courtroom. Just during my year and a half on this job, we've had a number of instances where hackers have been unable to resist the temptation to travel from whatever garden spot they live in and then got picked up. And the FBI is patient, but also dogged. And when they decide to travel, we'll be waiting. And just like China's playing the long game, so are we.
So to what extent are you concerned about foreign governments retaliating with similar measures against individuals who conduct operations on behalf of the United States?
Well, of course, we're always concerned about any tactic that some foreign government would use. But I want to be clear that the FBI is, there's no entity or individual that the FBI is afraid to go after if the rule of law supports it.
Director Wright, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. If you haven't yet, give the podcast a rating and review wherever you listen to it and share the Lawfare Podcast on Twitter and Facebook. As always, thanks for listening.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.